Good afternoon. There's no one obvious line or sequence of topics through this course because there are a considerable number of interconnections between them. So you'll see some illustrations of that, and you'll also see a link back to Qi's active, constructive, interactive framework halfway through. Now, my main agenda today, which I may or may not complete this session, is to introduce you to the biggest three theories, in my opinion, that have been around for a while but do more than most to illuminate some of the things that seem important about the quality and effectiveness of teaching and learning in higher education. So, first up, I'm going to introduce you to the work of William Perry. He was working as some sort of student advisor at Harvard in the 1960s, I think, 70s maybe. And 68, right. So these are interviews done in the 60s. It was a big interview study of Harvard undergraduates. In fact, as I'll mention later, it was only men, and it was only liberal arts students, humanities students rather than scientists. But nevertheless, he offers this idea, which, however mistaken some of his framing was, I've continued to think as one of the important dimensions along which to angle any course or approach in higher education. What he had in his mind as a presupposition was an explicit analogy to Piaget's stage theory. So you've probably come across developmental lectures on Piaget's ideas of stages, and Piaget's view was not that there was one age for one stage, but that each child nevertheless went through the same sequence, faster or slower, was the general idea. So Perry was looking for something that would be an important description of a developmental process in undergraduates, and he assumed it was sequential. And so his idea was that the business of universities in general, and Harvard in particular, was that students would arrive with a crude and simplistic idea about what knowledge is, and if the university was doing its job, they'd leave with a mature and sophisticated one, and how disappointed it was that only about a third of Harvard students made it to its top stage by the end. Perry discriminated 9 stages. If you get the book out of the library, if it's still in the library, you'll see a big diagram of all 9 stages. But I came across it because there was a research unit in this university for science education that simplified it down to 3 main stages, which are certainly easier to talk about and useful in empirical studies as well as introductory lectures. So, the importance of this handout is I can reproduce tables here that will never make it onto the screen in legible form. So we'll begin with handout page 1 and the upper table there. So his the idea really is that a student is likely to begin in position A and should progress through B to C eventually, and that you can describe or capture aspects of that shift in different ways. So position A, student thinks the student role is as a passive acceptor, the lecturer's role is as an authority giving facts and know-how, and they shouldn't bother students with ideas that we don't know what the answer is, and you have to worry about that. In fact, they get quite angry if you do that. That knowledge is essentially, the view of knowledge is that it's factual, it's black and white. Even exceptions are unwelcome, let alone objections. That exams should be regurgitation of facts. That exams are objective. Sorry. you're probably believing they are, but you ought to be sophisticated enough to know they depend on human judgment, and that hard work will be rewarded, and that the student confidence really completely depends upon the teacher. In position B, they've progressed or have had to face the idea that there's some kind of responsibility rests with the students, but they're very unclear what it is. Typically, students in position B are a lot less happy than those in either A or C. They've seen the problems with A, they've got no idea how to progress. They think the lecturer's role is still as an authority, but and where their controversy is that the lecturer is obliged to mention, they're just listening with razor-sharp ears for the lecturer to let drop which the right one really is, or at least which one the lecturer prefers. So they may be relativists, not in the sense they believe one's better than the other, but they believe that one's the right thing to mention in an exam, and the rest will be wrong. They're admitting that black and white approach is not appropriate, but they don't understand any reliable way to choose between alternatives. They tend to, at exams, to think that quantity is more important than quality, because it shows you no more, nothing. And they got little confidence and a lot of uncertainty. Position at the end of this trajectory is the students seeing themselves as a source of knowledge, or at least they're confident of finding it themselves. They're able to debate things and want to make their own decisions about which view they prefer. They seek interconnections. A lecturer as one authority among others, if they're being polite, or they might see the teacher as a facilitator or gateway to the knowledge that's in the library or can be found elsewhere, as long as you know what you're looking for. That knowledge is a matter of competing views or theories with different supports, and that what matters there is that it's evidence, not just conclusions, are important, and which allow you to decide, or at least give a rational argument for why one theory should be preferred over another. They're thinking that quality is more important than quantity, and they really like it when they have room to express their own ideas and views. So if this department's been doing its job, you're probably doing fairly well on C, that you recognise the enjoyment about things like critical reviews, and you're fed up with listening to other people's fixed opinions. So there's certainly aspects of that you're getting. Now, okay, so if you care to look at page 2 of the handout, or take the page, you'll see the top left is a little segment on Perry that you've just seen. Segment 2, aspects of the issues he uncovered. One is that it's partly about the content, and I've probably spoken well enough to that. It's partly about critical thinking. So if you want a tag for this theory, it represents to me what we're more familiar with calling critical thinking. It's thinking about a dimension of students acquiring the ability and the ability to apply it to their subject. However, there are different ways of thinking about this. So one of the things that's interesting about Perry is, from our point of view, is he assumes it's about the student and a student trait that isn't fixed but goes through development. But Deanna Kuhn, who's much more of a psychologist, has done work in this area and published a whole book. And whereas Perry presupposes it's about a student's theory of knowledge, his epistemology, Diana Kuhn assumes, with just as little testing of her assumption, that it's simply a skill that you can train people in critical thinking. They practice a bit and then they can do it. So he just assumes it's a cognitive skill, like, I don't know, mental arithmetic or something. So that would be a different perspective on this area. or we could think about it as personal development. Now, I'll deal with the bottom left segment, the Lenki et al. So, as I've already mentioned, Paris sample was entirely white, upper class males. Belenki and three collaborators, all women, they expressed this so politely. They point out this might not be a sample of all possible learners, and it might be interesting to do a bit of research on other people, and in particular women. And they nevertheless thought that was worthwhile, because like me, they thought Perry was saying something important. Even if he hadn't framed it right or done it extensively enough, there was something important in there. So Belenki et al. Produced this book of chapters of various studies that I cite there, and there's been at least one follow-up to that. And out of that, I mean, various things came out of that. And out of that came some adjustments, and one of the more dramatic ones was one of them. I've forgotten which, but you can find out from the book easily enough. They produced several variations, but there's two I thought so important I wanted them even in a summary. So this is table two on page one, which has now got more columns. So first of all, and this was, I think, the biggest shock to me, was having a position way below A. And this arose out of a study of essentially abused and very poor rural women in the USA. So many of them were so bullied by their husbands that they felt themselves incapable of knowing anything, and that's because if they said anything, it'd be contradicted. If they did anything they hadn't been ordered to do, they'd be punished, and it induced this sort of helplessness. And I think that's important, not only because it's clearly true of some, but after a bit I began to think about areas of learning where actually I have a very helpless kind of attitude. So I suppose dancing might be one, music might be another. Dancing's probably the best. I not only know I can't do it, I believe I can't, couldn't learn it. So when you look at this, if you're in this position in some sense, you just react to external demands. You think of the lecturer or your husband or the personal authority is making these arbitrary demands you don't understand and can't predict, that it's not possible to know things. Anything like an exam's just meaningless torture. And really, student confidence depends on being told what to do, and without that they'd be helpless. I don't know if any of you can on the spot think of an area of learning, since you're here, probably not academic learning, that actually that's kind of how you feel, that you think it's beyond knowing anything and that you'll always be entirely dependent on external stimuli to operate in that area in any sense. You're so full of self-efficacy and learning you can learn anything, and soon you'll be flapping your arms and flying like the birds. I think too that perhaps I should connect that position of not just areas where I believe myself to be helpless, but to areas where there's something about the instruction that, although not painful, kind of induces that. And so in quite a lot of science and engineering labs put on for students are often very extensive worksheets giving instructions. And I used to, long ago, have some work as a demonstrator in one of those. And when I was following my colleagues' instructions as opposed to the ones I wrote myself, I'd feel this was easy and I'd done it, but it would leave no trace in my mind because the instructions were sufficiently detailed. They didn't require me to problem solve. I just had to execute them. So I certainly didn't have the sensation of learning from them, except in an experiential sense. So it might be another connection. It's probably worth thinking, though, in connection with especially higher education systems, which aren't because they're not compulsory, is that we're not likely to see this in higher education because people will not volunteer for it. So if you were to work either in university recruitment or you believed everybody needs and deserves higher education, you'll probably have to make that program a social reality, you'd have to be ready for people who don't think they're capable and ask yourself what you're going to do about that. Because up to now, higher education people effectively self-select for it and they self-select their discipline, so they typically don't try and learn something which they aren't somehow already confident about. Now, completely different, one of the things that came out of Olenki and her colleagues was ideas which Perry didn't have about the intermediate route between position B and position C. So this tends to be labelled about students in a procedural position, and that's about them following rules, feeling confident about following the rules, even though they've got the idea there's evidence and things like that, they're picking up the rules perhaps before they're picking up any fully independent idea about drawing their own conclusions. And if you want to read more about that, there's on the course page there's reference to relatively short articles just about that aspect, as well as the book itself. Right, what have we got next? Now, I'm just going to do a little demo by picking on two of you, and what I want to do is to get two people to address something, and then I'll try and point out something about the way it's natural to have responded. So, first of all, I don't know, this is a possible scenario. Someone that you feel like indulging asks you a very general question about, tell me about music, and you know you've got about 30 seconds, so who's feeling overconfident? Yes, you'll be great. Just speak about music for about 30 seconds. What are the first 30 seconds worth of things you'd say?
Well, music is structured as a sound in many varieties. It can be done using human sounds or musical instruments. It has been done throughout human history and has developed into multiple genres that different people like different kinds of music. There's no one way to do it properly.
Okie dokie. So if you were going to give 30 seconds on arithmetic, let's have someone else. You want to have a go, Miguel?
Arithmetic.
What's the first 30 seconds worth that you would say about arithmetic to
So it's the science of calculation. It helps us to train our skills in sums that are necessary, sums and other operations that are necessary in real life. So it's important to train that. So that, yeah.
Okay, so the contrast which is there in those contributions is that even in 30 seconds, talking about music the speaker felt obliged to say there were different kinds of music and you can't expect to convince anyone. There's no way of deciding, whereas that never occurred to Miguel or indeed any other normal person, except mathematics postgrads, to mention that there are differences of opinion about arithmetic. And why I'm saying that is because we have, generally speaking, it's not just we the people in the class, quite a young child like 10 years old would probably say the same thing. They're quite capable of understanding that one of the first things you learn about music is there's no accounting for tastes, but that all the people they know regard arithmetic as a fixed black and white thing. So that means that music is treated as periposition B. There's no evidence, but you can't get away from diverse opinions, whereas arithmetic is treated as periposition A. And that's a demonstration that generally works in lectures. As soon as I point that out, I think you'll probably accept that young children already know that, and that completely contradicts Perry's presupposition that these are about fixed attitudes that once you have them, you apply to all kinds of knowledge. Instead, how we treat a topic in Perry's terms depends on what the topic is. It's much more like, along with each topic, we acquire a view of whether the subject itself, at least for our purposes, is a natural for one of these peripositions. That doesn't mean Perry's spectrum isn't interesting, but it seems to me it's not a trait in or a development in the individual so much as it can be viewed as part of the subject matter. And indeed, it's important for us to know that. I thought about this a little more in terms of another context, which is whether people entering a new group, for instance, in week zero, new level ones entering a huge peer community of other students, what does it take to make you feel at home? And I thought about this a bit because I used to run these big induction sessions. I'd get the audience to say what their top concerns were on day one, and we'd discuss the top 10, and obviously that was a huge success in many ways, but of course we weren't going to get to say, what's a gay man coming in going to feel like? Is he going to be able to mention that or not? Because that would be a minority, it wouldn't make the top 10. But thinking about that, I realized that what you need perhaps above all in being able to deal with a new group is not so much whether you fill their favourite criteria, but that you know what their attitudes are, and therefore, if, for instance, you say you support Partick Thistle, you know everyone will roar with laughter, but they won't be offended because they despise it. It's that kind of thing. It's knowing what the group feels, and you tune what you say that's personal in order to directly interface with that general consensus. So, if you know that everyone regards music as or nearly everyone is a matter of taste, and there's no point in arguing, that tells you not to earnestly proselytize unless you can be very amusing about it, that if you discuss arithmetic with them, you have to expect them to think it's black and white, even if you're sophisticated enough to know that binary arithmetic, all the operations feel very different and all the rest of it. So I think that's another social reason why we probably pick up, with every topic, we pick up very early on the kind of Perry attitude that people in general have to it. Right, where were we? So that was that. Have I more or less done enough on that? Now, did any of you look at that rebuttal of Perry that I mentioned? I know, he began to get to me a bit, but then I thought this might be because I didn't read it any sooner than you did. But then in the end, I think the serious question is how to translate Perry to science education, because it came out of humanities, and it's very noticeable if you look at who mentions the word critical. You absolutely have to if you're a sociologist. You pretty much, that's your main business. As if you're learning history or English literature, you don't hear real scientists say critical much. But it doesn't mean they don't debate, it's just they don't conceive of it in the same language. So I also thought it was interesting, not just because it was shouty, but because of the attitude it seemed to embody, which was of a huge fan of science. He wanted to be very Perry type A about it, because he didn't want to be bothered to give reasons why he thought creationists were idiots. And of course I completely sympathise with that emotion. It's not a very respectable emotion. So I think, to take him more seriously perhaps than he deserves, assuming it's a he actually, no names, but I suppose we all perceive shoutiness as definitely characterising males, yes. Because of course, except on TV, ladies never shout. The other thing I thought he exposed, though, was the difference between a science fan and or consumer and being a research scientist yourself. So I'm an enormous consumer, fan of science, and but what a lot of that means is reading short reports in New Scientist that on topics I wouldn't remotely be competent to do independent critical thinking of. And if you, for instance, I don't know, get a job in the civil service, or a junior, you have to do some research, produce a report to the minister, you'll be consuming whatever evidence you can find in a similar way. And the less you know about an area, the more you would like to be able to trust what you see and not think too hard about the evidence. But I think, in spite of being a fan more than a thinking like a research physicist, for instance, it pokes through in various ways. So that recent discovery of a detection of gravitational waves, it's quite hard to make that a story that anybody cares about outside physics, although they had a good go. But reading some of the best bits, I began to piece together just how much that community distinguishes between a theory they really expect to be right, since Einstein proposed it and there's been no contradiction, but that they've been trying to get those measurements essentially for a whole 100 years, and at last they'd managed it. And that relief, it wouldn't be relief if they put theory or authority over testable facts. That relief is about actually how different it is when you know for sure that's right, and not just a pinnacle of inference that's going to crumble. I'll just mention this other point. Richard Feynman was a famous 20th century physicist, but he's also famous because he was very good to listen to from the outside as well, and one of the things he was much more sharp about than most people, including practical physicists, was to fully understand the difference between discovering a phenomenon and giving it a name versus, in any other sense, understanding it. Just because you've given it a technical name actually doesn't mean you understand anything about it. And it's very easy for scientists to forget that, and certainly for readers of scientists to forget that. I think the critical point I'd probably be stimulated by that little critique about, though, is about a critique of science degrees, because I absolutely adored doing physics in university, but in this kind of hindsight I wonder if it wasn't a failed course, because it just taught me to adore physics results. It didn't teach me to think, that's puzzling, I'll go out and do an experiment. On the contrary, I'd read authority as if I was doing scripture studies in medieval times. So I think that's another thing to look out for. I think it's there are all sorts of excuses for physics because there's so much content that you can't remotely any longer cram it into an undergraduate course. But if you're meant to be teaching in any way what it is to be a physicist, to do research, you have to be doing exercises about the places where physics is uncertain and what they do to fix that. So, not completely unrelated to that, I wonder if it would be good to add a further periposition off the top end where you don't just make the best decision you can as you're doing a critical review, you actually decide how you're going to find out for sure. And there was a very interesting documentary I saw a couple of years ago by a biologist about who'd had been reading Aristotle's book on biology and how impressive it was to modern eyes, how very different from everyone else at the time, how in many ways it would look like it would be it was organized like a modern biology book. But he eventually got around to saying the one difference was that Aristotle didn't, besides being very active as a researcher in some ways, interviewing fishermen, doing dissections and so on, he didn't create experiments to shed decisive new light on his theories. And the example this presenter gave was of a spontaneous generation of life, which remained a controversial theory for another 2,000 years. Whereas in fact you can do a decisive experiment, which was clearly within Aristotle's reach, he just didn't think like that, because you can put out two lumps of meat in the sun, cover one with a muslin cloth, and the one with the muslin cloth the flies can't lay their eggs on, the other one they do. So you can actually do a decisive experiment without modern technology. But Aristotle didn't think like that, impressive as he was in every other way. I think another point I'd add about Perry is thinking about this arc of development. So last time I think I gave that anecdote about a science teacher thinking about how his children would not quite likely never have been exposed to an argument based on reason. There's also let me put it in a way that's probably important for you in your careers, which is that not all, but a lot of the modern world revolves around bureaucratic committee decisions, and more they're likely to be influenced by evidence. And there's a whole way of speaking in that around evidence-based arguments. That's probably the world you're going to be moving in. Being passionate doesn't get points in those circles. In fact, it's viewed a bit like, they say, 18th century England was thoroughly sick of the Puritans, and they had a word for that, which was enthusiasm, which meant these preachers who would bang the table and try and get you to repent. And that was essentially labelling visible enthusiasm as a sign of someone who was irrational and had no evidence. And quite a lot of committees will work like that. So you might say there's a sort of, you might put it as strongly nowadays, that there's a graduate attribute there. You can also put it another way, not about getting your own influence in committees, but simply when you say you work in retail, what's that about? It's about dealing with customers, not exposing your beliefs that will annoy them, dealing with them in a positive but essentially insulated way to get the business done. The whole idea that in cities, which is almost all of life these days, we're dealing all the time with people we've never seen before, know nothing about them personally, do not have a personal relationship with them. What does it take for two people to have a productive social interaction? And that's very different from how things typically are as a young child in a normal, noisy family where everything is extremely personal. Change your views to annoy people or to please them. It's completely the opposite. So I don't think it's a natural human ability, but it's certainly one we can acquire and which is very useful today. So I think, in my mind, I would make at least a slight link between Perry and that. But I'd also say, I think one of the reasons why I feel Perry represents an important idea, however, despite the qualifications, it's somehow an important concept, is because there's a book now about 170 years old. It's written in the middle of the 19th century by Cardinal Newman, and it's essentially a justification of universities and a justification of learning for learning's sake. It's still occasionally referred to as the best articulation of that. But it's got all sorts of bits in it, and although he doesn't use this language, he has got passages which just remind me of Perry so much. And they sort of go like this. He gives a sketch which I can't quite do, but it's almost Jane Austen-like. His thinking, you see, universities at that time would have a lot of young men who came from middle-class families but weren't going to inherit any significant money. So it's very important, just like today, for them to get their qualification, get their entry into professions. But he contrasts what those undergraduates were typically like by the time they emerged from what it would be like for a self-taught person of way above average brightness. And he said the trouble with a self-taught person, the thing they'd miss, is they would know a lot, they'd have succeeded in learning a lot, but it would all be their opinion, and it would all be their construction of ideas, and sometimes they'd get it wrong and just be very defensive about it. And he said the real, or at least the unsung but valuable part of a university education of the kind he was saying, was you turn up from, you know, your small farm or small village, and there you are in halls next door to another young man similar like that, but who's been exposed to the same kind of things, but he just has different opinions about things, something you wouldn't get within your family. And getting used to living with people that you've got no general reason to admire or despise, but who are different from you, that's the education. Get it? I mean, to you, that's not a surprise. But it's another suggestion that somehow that peer process that gets you used to a diversity of views and gives you practice at how to handle yourself in that environment is somehow in itself one of the most important developmental things. That's what he's, I think, alluding to. Because after all, if you have a naive idea that things are right or wrong, then you are going to be like a religious fanatic. Because, I mean, if you're sincerely religious in the way few people can be today, it's very hard, logically, to get away from the idea, I have had this revelation, I must be right, it is a matter of your eternal soul, no amount of violence and pressure is too much to save you from that fate you're going to do. It's very hard to disengage from that level of belief within that framework. But that just stems from a Perrier view about the absolute nature of truth, and it's very important to get away from that for all sorts of reasons. Most of all, getting on with people who in most ways are like yourself but have just come to different conclusions from the same experiences. Now there's one other thing I want to slip in as something I came to later, but which I now think to some extent links with Perry. Hall, as you see, this is a book from 1959, I think there's a copy. I think the library owns a copy, but I managed to get one very cheap online anyway. It's thin and it's very readable, and you might even consider it the kind of thing you would amuse you on a summer holiday. He's an anthropologist. His experience was, I think, working with the American, what do they call their foreign office, State Department. And so he saw a lot and to some extent was involved in trying to help Americans trying to do business with people in completely other cultures. And in this, in the book, the full reference is in the, on the reading list, he chooses the example of time, you know, idea of time, something we all deal with. And then he shows how, completely contrary to everything I tacitly assumed before, that we learn aspects of what we know about time in completely different ways. So Hall offers three categories of knowledge, none of which are exactly Perry's, but they're probably all around position A. Let's now these are his words. I don't think I always have to look them up. They're not particularly felicitous for me, but I'll go through them because this had me thinking so hard. Now, when he talks about formal knowledge, what he means really is you learning something that's just a social convention, typically vocabulary, but legal requirements, all kinds of things. Or other things like your mother saying you mustn't swear, and you ask why, but you never get a question that an answer that makes any sense. It's a convention, you have to learn it, there aren't any reasons, there's no point in having any reasons. And of course that's not absent from science because it has its own vocabulary. It's no good me saying my rewording of a concept is better than other people's. To communicate scientists you have to put up with the vocabulary that's standard. Now the second one, which he called technical, and I think is his take on how the US military trains its specialists. So good examples would be, in civilian life as well, would be training someone in aircraft maintenance. And typically, you're trained what to do, and you're given reasons you have to learn about why you do it that way, but you're not allowed to argue about them. And you can see why that makes sense. So in aircraft maintenance, one thing that's important is doing it right so the plane doesn't crash. But it's also important, probably, that everyone does it the same way. So the next person in a different continent servicing it isn't faced with an engine that's got non-standard modifications with no explanation. So there's this mixture of strong engineering reasons but also social convention. And that leads to learning stuff with reasons but not being allowed to exercise any critical thought except for your understanding. And I think an example perhaps closer to home for you is what doctors call protocols, where they've got a fixed procedure, they've done research on that procedure, and now everyone has to do it, not because they think it's the best, but because it stops people doing different things so you can't compare data, it stops people making mistakes because they forgot a bit. So it's rigid in the same way, and there's some science behind it, but that's not the reason for the complete rigidity of are you following this protocol. So whereas I might say that formal stuff is like Perrier, reproduction, this has got an element of deep learning with the reasons, but you know, it's slightly better than A. But the bit that blew me away from an academic point of view is this informal stuff. And this is stuff you're never told. You're just punished till you get it right. So an example, if you had a slightly brutal mother would be getting a slap every time you swore, but she'd never say you mustn't swore, she'd just say don't say that or something like that. The example he gives is what got to me. He was talking about time, and one of the examples he gave was how in American business culture, this is probably true today, you make an appointment, if you're 2 minutes late you definitely have to apologize, but you're almost entirely confident that will be accepted. If you're an hour late, that might be the end of the relationship. That's much more serious. He says there are other cultures you go, if you're the supplement, they will think, they'll not only keep you waiting for 5 hours, they won't think that's an issue or needs to be mentioned. And how American businessmen don't understand that. So first of all, there's an interesting anecdote from anthropology. And then I thought, in today's society, probably a good example is, because this is clearly a microcultural issue, so you'll have experienced more than one, is how quickly are you expected to reply to an email? So there are definitely offices when if you haven't replied in 5 minutes, they send out a search party. There's others where 24 hours is the expected thing, others where maybe once a week. Now those are tremendously different times, so it's not an absolute law, but I've never heard anyone explain those rules. You're not told the rules, you find them out from practice. So that's why I suddenly realised part of what we pick up in general is through this other kind of learning mechanism, when not only aren't you told any reasons, you're not even told what it is you're learning, you just have to pick it up from practice. So if I put all of those together, that might be today's list of my peripositions, maybe. Right, so, since I got one enormous yawn already, what don't you understand yet about peri? The application of peri? Question. I think it's clear that Perry's a philosopher and applications aren't what he does. How would I apply it?
But like, what was he just, like, was he just saying it so he could say it? Or?
I think even on your page it said the application notes, or the provider there anyway.
Go on.
It just said how when the teacher sees that the student is stuck in the black and white position, how the teacher should push them further.
Yeah, I mean, I think he thought of it as an explanation from which another phase of research might do. So, as Clara said, one could think about improving your teaching to scaffold those transitions. I think I would think about it as one of a small number of tools for critiquing any given course design. How does it do on the peri dimension? Is there anything I should be doing differently? That's kind of what I was getting into in talking about science degrees and whether it's not that real scientists don't do critical thinking, but maybe that they actually never think about whether they're training undergraduates, the physics equivalent of that. Also, I think that point I tried to make with the demonstration about how it's not really these fixed epistemological positions, but we kind of pick up this information about each topic. That tells me something about what the curriculum really is in each topic, and I think teachers typically won't have that explicitly in mind, though they may be fine at conveying it without thinking about it. But I guess if I had a short course, that would be definitely one of the things. Actually, here's a little example. I suppose applies to that. When I was a postgrad, I went on a first aid course in the university. What was interesting about it was the same class had a handful of postgrads, a handful of secretaries, a few janitors, and one of the postgrads, clearly from a humanities department, I think, kept questioning the first aid teaching and asking for the scientific backing for it. What he had no idea about was that the point of first aid is to have a practical procedure which you can remember when you suddenly have to use it, having not thought about it for a year, and which might do some good but will definitely not kill anyone. And that doesn't mean you're going to give optimal treatment, which would assume total knowledge and perfect recall and a completely cool head when you're probably panicking over someone who's trying to die on you. He had no idea that perfect knowledge was not the main priority in first aid. It was this other kind of knowledge you needed. In the course of the postgrad, I was most deeply into wanting to understand things, and I wasn't quite as mad as him, but it made me think about kinds of knowledge and when they're appropriate.
Yeah.
and different kinds of appropriateness. So I guess I'd say being able to think critically about teaching and learning, Perry gives different kinds of prompts, I think, from others. Anything else? So you probably don't need that, but that might be my one slide summary of the aspects of this. I don't know if meta-knowledge is an agreed technical term, but what I mean is knowledge about knowledge. So about music, one of the things we know is that nobody believes there's any absolute truth in there. But also I think when you're well into critical thinking as a routine issue in what you're learning, part of that is you no longer think you just learn the facts and the conclusions, you need to learn reasons for them, you need to learn the degree of certainty of each conclusion, and probably you want to be picking up information on the degree of consensus about each conclusion and maybe who believes what and whether that looks self-interested or not. That certainly has some importance to someone in a science career, where part of what you want to know is what's the usual theory, what are the interesting new researchers doing, whether it would be fatal to your career to mention your interest or, on the contrary, do it good, all that kind of stuff about who knows leaves what before it's completely settled can be definitely interesting, useful. So that's a different view about what's actually been learned by students in any given topic. Right, second of the big theories, which I'll deal with more briefly. This is the quote from Simon I had in mind. He once said or wrote, if you know the name of a given bird in 20 languages, you know something about people, nothing about birds. Now, deep and surface learning. So, this is on the handout. Page 2, right hand side. I should probably give you an introduction first. Right, so if you've done a little pre-reading, you'll have seen that this, I'll come on to these bits in a moment, you'll have seen that this comes out of work first in Scandinavia and later in Scotland on what were on learners, individual students' approaches to learning, and the biggest contrast was between deep and surface. Surface is about rote reproduction, or a slightly more sophisticated version would be identifying the kind of test you're going to get, training yourself to answer that test, not learning anything else, just focused on the predicted test task. Deep learning is, by contrast, is having no such limits and learning many things that are connected with it. So my interpretation of what deep learning really is departs quite a long way from the original research base on student attitudes. I would now say that deep learning is about forming as many connections as possible to the new thing you're learning, but not just quantity, but types of connections. So if you connect it to reasons rather than just conclusions, that would be one type. If you connect it to personal experiences, that will be another kind of link, and so on. One of the implications is that you've never finished learning. There is no end to deep learning. One of the attractions of surface learning is you have a finite target and you stop when you've reached it. So here are a few different kinds of connection. One would be to connect the general concept to specific examples. How many of you do that as a regular internal discipline when someone mentions something? Do you think of examples of the concept, or do you just memorize the concept and the definition? Well, I think it's good. It's not that easy. One of the things I most learn from learning is, I know this concept so well, here it is, I'll just give an example because I know that's good practice, and then there's this massive pause while I can't think of one, even though I felt total confidence the moment before. So it's also a good test of depth of understanding. So concept to example is one kind of link. Concept to a personal experience, how you feel, how it looks. So for example, to take something from simple school physics, if you've ever suffered through a basic science course, you've probably had to learn Newton's law that force equals mass times acceleration. You might even be able to reproduce the definition of those. But a typical personal link to that would be, which of course only normally the keen, well, the people who love the subject rather than keen to get high marks do, is to think about a supermarket trolley, because they're usually, their wheels work quite well and the floor is flat and smooth, and noticing that it takes quite a push to get it moving and almost no push to keep it moving. If you even wanted to take that further, you'd get a rather poorly inflated balloon, quite a squashy balloon, put it between you and your hand, and you can see by the deflection in the balloon what force you're applying, and you can connect that to the fact, because the counterintuitive thing about Newton's law is that it doesn't take any force to keep moving, force just changes the speed. But that kind of, I will have more on that at a later point, but that's just a different kind of connection. So, for instance, in theories of emotion, a more complicated version of this is that on the one hand is connecting words like anger or anxiety to your own feelings about that. A completely different connection, though, is connecting them to how another person looks when they're having those feelings. So emotions are unusual, as you've actually got two different sets of experiences to link that to. Another type of connection will be between concepts. So, well, I'll go actually with Alison's first of all. What did Perry do with it? That's suggesting that the first link she thinks about is applications. Entirely appropriate in an applied subject like education. But another one would be to rival theories. So in an ununified field like education, I'm trying to think all the time about whether some new sounding concept is new or just a rewording of an old one. If it is new, can I convince myself it's independent of the old ones, and therefore, although it might co-occur in some cases, it really is an independent concept. And you can only work that stuff out by endlessly thinking about interactions between concepts. Another one, of course, is trying to think of counterexamples. Another one, seldom used though, would be to ask of some new thing that comes under your eyes, whether it solves any old problems that you've never understood before but might be able to adapt the new concept to explaining them. Have any of you come across Pentridge's theories of motivation? Okay. If you ever look at theories of motivation, his is probably the first name you'd like to come up. He has a distinction between what he calls mastery versus performance goals, and that distinction seems similar, at least, to where performance would be surface learning. You're doing it for one activity, and that's the end of your motivation when you've got that. By mastery, I think he means knowing more than is immediately necessary. I think educationalists will generally believe that deep and surface correlate with far versus near transfer, and probably also with the length of retention. Certainly, a few years ago now, I collaborated for a bit with a high school teacher in South Glasgow, and one of the things she said under the radio, because as you know there's endless tests pupils do, is at the end of the year they had these tests and the school's rankings depend on them, so the teachers spend the last few weeks cramming them for these tests, and that fixes the results for 1 year. But she says all except the worst teachers spend a lot of the year attempting deep learning, because if they haven't learnt it deeply, they won't be able to cope with the year after. So deep learning is usually associated with more understanding and a better foundation for the future. But if you know the type of test you're getting immediately, you probably don't need that, and it won't be very obvious on those test scores. And of course, the bad news for me, from a school perspective, they did that every year except the last, because then they were going to university and it's someone else's problem, having students who had no real understanding of their last year of tuition, just got high test scores. There's just one other thing I haven't managed to get on that slide. Yes, okay, so I'll talk about this in just a second. I'll probably mention it in a later lecture, but here it comes anyway. There's a book which had a big impact on me by Snyder. Benson Snyder, and it was based on interviews. He was studying final year undergraduates at MIT, which is essentially best engineering school in the USA, and the title of the book is A Hidden Curriculum, and a lot of it is about the daftness of the way the lecturers go about it. But one of the two very interesting things, one is that the most interesting thing that really is that different students in a typical engineering class at that time in that institution would orient to different tests. So a common practice was to have a weekly quiz, and there was one bunch of students who absolutely wanted to beat all the other people in the room, and that is what they would focus on. Of course, a weekly quiz is not going to be, it's just one particular test format. Another bunch would be interested in their end of semester grade point average, and they would do their most intelligent best at getting the highest grade. But there was another kind of student, and he said, when he went back a year later, these were the ones who'd come back as postgrads. As undergraduates, they would look at this overstuffed curriculum. You probably think, this course is overstuffed. Snyder's book is about how all the honours courses were ridiculously overfull of content. That meant that even the best students had to decide what fragment they were going to do, and he had some interesting interviews. Those who were interested in engineering, wanted to do it later, would not ask what this is going to do for my test scores. In the short run, it will be which bits of this subject might actually be useful beyond the end of the module, which is a completely different way for a student to think about and to judge what they're going to learn. So, although the easiest definition of surface learning is to think about a specific test, it's complicated partly by the fact that different students will, in the context where there is more than one kind of assessment, including their own, will orient to the different standards. The other thing, though, I should mention is deepened surface is still mainly thought of as based on the Scandinavian work on learner approaches to learning, and at one point it's tempting, at least for Brits and Americans, to interpret this as a trait of a student. But there was immediately the data tended to contradict this, because it's entirely possible for a teacher to produce a course which induces shallow learning in everyone, regardless of student preference, but no one knows how to design a course which forces students to learn deeply. And the way of resolving that is to realize that it's not a relation between two things, there's a relation between three things. There's the student, theirs, and what skills and goals they have. There's the learning context, in particular the design of the course, and then there's which strategy gets applied. So it's not good to slip into thinking about it as a trait. You can only really explain the data by thinking about this as a relationship between three things. And that's often missed in simplistic thinking in psychology and education. So it's actually a general lesson always worth thinking about in other contexts, but it certainly applies in this area. I'll talk more about reflection later in the course, but deep learning is to a great extent linked to this, because in the end most of those links you establish by searching your own mind to make connections between other things you know. But here's a thought. So it's clear from the English language rhetoric about this, calling it deep and surface or deep and shallow, that shallow is bad, deep is good, and you can hear me signing up unthinkingly to those values. But there is actually a possible counterexample. I'm not a deep reader of the literature on animal learning, but there are certainly suggestions there that when, for instance, a chimp learns a technique from another chimp, that they don't in fact imitate it closely. They have their goal in mind, and they're influenced by the fact that the other chimp can do something, but they don't tend not to imitate exactly what they're doing. They try and get at that goal picking up hints. Humans, however, I think it's quite striking when you think about it. Humans will learn stuff that they don't understand in any way. So if you think, perhaps this is too out of date, but it certainly was a cliche when I was a child, children would often play doctors and nurses. They put on the white coat, they'd fake a stethoscope, and when you think about that, there is absolutely no medical knowledge in there. They're not interested in healing the other, they're interested in enacting something. Now, if it's true, as some hints and research literature would have it, that humans are unusual in being capable of learning something without understanding what it's for, is that balmy, or actually could it be a special advantage? Because by learning stuff when you don't need it, there's obviously at least a slight chance it will be there when you need it, when the need arises. It would also fit with Vygotskian kind of ideas about child learning, where the adult holds all the meaning at first, and the child only gradually learns the meaning when as they go through it. So it could be that learning to imitate, which obviously is important in language learning, is actually in humans much more generally valuable. Now, how would this apply to academia? Well, thinking about deep and surface learning immediately makes one depressed about how the exams so often do more to get students to reproduce the names of concepts and references in the literature which they don't necessarily understand. But is that a complete loss? So I set myself to try and imagine what it would be like on the one hand for a learner that was all deep, and on the other hand a learner that was all surface. And I have to say that certainly today, but really for quite a long time I think in human society, if all you've done is learn the names of things, the great thing that does is you can get what you want later, because those names are what you look up today in Wikipedia, but 50 years ago that would be in a library index or from an expert. You can phone up an expert around the world, and if you use the right keywords you'll get the right knowledge out of them. If you don't know what language is right for what it is you want to learn, you're screwed. So learning these meaningless terms actually means you go away with the key to knowledge. You might not have bothered to use the key yet, you might not have had time, but actually unlocks it. Whereas suppose you were a genius into rediscovering everything, you will never recreate anything like all of human knowledge, but you might reconstruct more than one would imagine, but you still wouldn't be able to talk to anyone about it, because you wouldn't have a common ground for discussing the thing you'd rediscovered. So romantic as it is to be someone who learns by rediscovering, it would cut you off from the social network which has so much to do with not only improving your knowledge but also being of use to other people. So I think it's important to realize that while shallow learning is not having learned all you ideally would, it is still having learned something that is valuable and is valuable in the future. I adore the feeling of understanding, but I'm learning more and more that that's not a necessary condition for worthwhile learning. Yeah.
Could you say that
No, I believe they're independent. Everyone always asks that question, and I think that's because when we first hear anything we code it as good and bad, and so we think the good go together and the bad go together. A student some years ago, in the forerunner of this course, a student asked that question, and I wasn't really ready for it. So I wrote an essay about, with examples, to show different combinations, and there's a pointer to it up on the web page about the connection between Perry on the one hand, deep and surface on another, and Lorillard's model, which is the third, and trying to find examples where you can be good on one and useless on another. So you might be a deep learner who's got far more types of connections than most people, but if none of them were to reasons, then it wouldn't count with Perry. You know. So that might be a mechanic who didn't question the theories but had thought a lot about their application, about how to apply them, how to connect his personal experiences. None of that would be questioning the reasons, but it would be rich in terms of many of these other connections. So that would be one kind of example. I think someone who scored the maximum on Perry's dimension on critical thinking would be stuffed with reasons, but that's only one kind of connection. Might look, you know, that would be better than a strictly surface learning, but it might not be all that good compared to someone who'd invested in half a dozen other kinds of connection.
you talk about that someone is deep learner or surface learner, so couldn't one just kind of take an approach to Amazon what the motivation is? So say that I'm motivated to get a high mark on exam, because I know if I get high marks on exam, I could continue on with a master and a PhD.
Yeah, no, you can. I mean, I think students do select an approach. There's a question about whether they have all the approaches open to them, but if they do, then they still have the choice. And indeed, you certainly see that in people. I mean, there are things that I want to think deeply about, like this stuff, and there's things I just want the right answer to, like which really is the best gas boiler to buy. And even though I'm kind of interested in the insides, I'd rather not be using critical thinking. I'd just like certainty, please.
Something in between about
users
asked about. It said there's a third form.
Yes, strategic. So this would be students, probably there are many in your class, couldn't possibly be personal about you, who realize that the kind of exam they're facing, pure surface won't work, but they just tune themselves to what's required and don't do anything that isn't directly required. So that would be a strategic learner. It isn't quite the same thing, but in a otherwise poor quality science fiction book, I read this sentence that probably the author hadn't thought about at all, but which made me think. He was making the distinction between an expert and a scholar. And he was essentially saying an expert is someone who knows everything in an area that's important in practice. And a scholar is someone who's read everything regardless of whether it's useful. And I think the scholar is the far out in the deep end. They don't need to know in advance it's going to be useful. They'll just do it anyway. So if you take a football fan, some of them got ridiculous amounts of numbers in their head, which the rest of us don't see the point of. But for them it's effortless and very enjoyable. Would you like a break for the last half hour? Run round the room, do a relay race? Right, you want page 3 on the handout. Top of page 3. Right. I should be able to get the basics of Yoga. Lorillard models are much bigger. I think it's the single best theory I've seen of learning and teaching in higher education. Doesn't mean I can't come up with criticisms, but it combines more things in one than others. Now if you look at the diagram, the model consists of 12 activities, those are the rounded boxes. But they, my way of presenting this is to present it in terms of three underlying principles. So, you can see in the diagram there's a symmetry between left and right, and that corresponds between the role of teacher and the role of learner. So one of the principles is about that. You can see there's a symmetry between the top and bottom. The top is about abstract articulations of concepts, and the bottom is about practical work as in a lab. And and that's the second principle about connecting to personal, preferably sensory motor experience. But the other principle underlying this is the way there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and in this diagram from her original edition of her book. She has four activities here, but what that really means is there's two, and then they go around the loop as much as necessary, and you can see that all over the diagram. So my take on her model is this is the multiplying together of three principles and expressing these in terms of learning activities. And to anticipate the Ellison question, although my first interest is how much of observations I've already made, can I explain with the Lorillard model, I actually think it's very useful in principle. If you're designing a course of any kind, you can use these learning activities as a critical checklist, asking your course design, how are you covering these 12 activities? And certainly what Lorillard said when she published the book was she'd never yet seen a course design that managed to cover them all. So it's it can be used as a practical tool. And in fact, given the way time's going, I think I would recommend to you as homework taking the Lorillard's 12 activities, taking a course you're interested in, and trying to critique it, trying to say which of these activities are explicitly represented, which are probably happening but invisibly in the student's head, and which are clearly neglected and something ought to be done about that. And you can just pick what you like. I mean, you can do this course, you can do another course, you can think of a course you might design. For instance, I once had a student who was worked for Oxfam, and she thought about redesigning the induction training for people going to work for Oxfam. Probably apply it to all kinds of things. This slide corresponds to the other part of the top of the handout page, and it's a more readable textual list of her 12 mathemagenic activities. So the top four are the ones at the top of the diagram. 5 to 8 are at the bottom, and 9 to 12 are the linking top to bottom. So that's to orient you. I'm now going to structure most of what I say in terms of these three principles. This is a short list. I'll have separate slides on each one. So I'll just say briefly what each is. So what I call principle A, is that Lorillard, unlike quite a lot of theorists, gives equal weight to teacher and learner. So there are a lot of cuddly liberals who think we should have student-centered teaching, and teachers should pay much more attention to the learner than to themselves. That, of course, doesn't fit with the evidence that how good well the teacher does has an enormous effect on the child. Lorillard is much more realistic about this. They have different importances, but they're both equally important, because you also have reactionary attitudes that it's all about the teacher and not about the learner at all. And the fact is, it depends on both. And so one of the things that certainly when she published it I thought was outstanding here is she had a much more sensible attitude to paying attention to both teacher and learner. Principle B, feedback and conversion, it's about that to-ing and fro-ing in terms of your current student experience. That's related, for instance, to getting feedback on your work or not. It's also about the idea that in most cases of anything worth learning intellectually, you aren't going to get it like that in a few seconds. So that means you'll have a rough idea and you need somehow to test it out, whether you're testing yourself or someone else. You get feedback from that attempt, try again, and get closer. So I think a bit like, I don't know, water going down a plug hole, or perhaps more, yes. So I mean, it swirls around, but gradually it all converges and ends up in the same place, even though individual drops of water will have got rather different trajectories. They're all moving in one way, and if you go on long enough, they'll get the whole thing. And principle C has already been mentioned. This is about linking personal and experience and public or formal descriptions. And as you know, university teaching is heavily biased towards the public formal one, often doesn't do enough or does nothing about personal experience. Right, so one way of telling an imaginary history of the field is the crudest kind of theory about learning and teaching is the transmission theory. It's all about the teacher. There's a cartoon that's often quoted called the Nuremberg Funnel, which shows a learner strapped to a chair with a hole drilled in their head and a great big funnel there and the teacher pouring it in. If you're sophisticated, you may laugh at that, but I think why it's never going to go away is because in everyday life, when it's a matter of a bit of information rather than the difficult theory, we absolutely think about it in transmission terms. In fact, socially on the whole, if I ask your name and you tell me, next time I see you I can't remember the name, you'll probably be faintly insulted, but tell me again. But if this goes on more than three times, you definitely start to think I'm mentally deficient, and that will be true about other facts. We expect people to absorb simple facts, and we simply judge them if they don't. And that is a completely transmission theory kind of thing, and it's actually not a bad approximation as long as it's low-level information. It's a different business when you're trying to understand a tricky concept. Now, simple constructivism, as represented by Piaget, is essentially learner-centered. Piaget's focus is on changes in the child and an emphasis on how the child constructs the knowledge in rather mysterious ways. They certainly don't just learn to repeat something that teachers do, at least not in the learning that Piaget focused on. So that's the respectable ancestry of a learner-centered view. But as I mentioned before, it actually doesn't take into account the enormous difference a teacher makes and the enormous difference the quality of the teacher makes. You've actually got to think about both of them. So Lorillard describes her model as in a family of conversational models, which I suppose Vygotsky is, so I don't remember her mentioning that. And these think about dialogue as the correct metaphor for the interaction, that learning depends on the interaction. In some sense, it's a conversation. Now, her label is to say it's about the teacher, but really, in a university, you have to think about that as the name of a role, not the name of a person. It is about setting up, in her model, two poles for interactions and representing both the source and the destination. And there are two aspects to that, not just who is telling whom, but that what a learner can learn at a given moment depends very strongly on what they already know. You quite often get teachers acting, certainly university teachers acting as without thinking much about what the learner already knows. But actually, whenever you hear something new, if you're not just going to learn to recite a foreign language, where foreign here means science jargon without any understanding, you have to think about what they've already got for several reasons. One is what to build on, but the other is, in many cases, particularly basic science, but basic almost anything, is we generally have some sort of prior conception. And if that's very different from the theory being taught, it's no good acting as if the learner just has to accept this stuff. They will have in them strong ideas that fight it, and the typical outcome is that the teacher doesn't make allowances for that, and the child learns what they might call school physics. I talk about physics in this way to my physics teacher and to the examiner, but I think about my interactions with physical objects entirely separately. And that those just become isolated areas in the learner's mind. If serious allowances aren't made for thinking about the the knowledge, including misinformation, state of the learner when they come in. Now, although in many ways teacher and learner look symmetric glancing at the diagram, that's absolutely not. Of course, the teacher and learner have complementary, not identical roles, and there's no mystery about that. If you think about if you think of the metaphor of planning a journey, you might hear sentences like how do I travel to London, but it's no good replying to that with a route from New York to London. A journey depends on the start just as much as it depends on the end. So again, you have to think about that. There's an asymmetry here and need to take account of it. Now, what Lalla's diagram doesn't represent, but is clearly true, is that the knowledge you want university students to learn is diffuse across society, and it's not wholly in the head of the teacher, or even mainly in the head of the teacher. So the diagram gives a simplistic view that isn't correct, but that doesn't mean this model isn't useful. It's just that teaching is a role rather than an individual person, at least at university level. Principle C Right, so this is about how ideally we would link abstract theory to personal, often sensory motor experience. And I believe this is true in every subject. So in physics, I gave you the example of pushing a trolley as a way of linking physics. But literature, at university, students learn to write a critical essay in the mode and style and discourse of lit crit, and yet they're usually writing about, let's say, works of fiction. You could obviously have a student who could write those essays but never went to the theatre or never enjoyed a novel, but it would be a much more complete learning if they made those links. In economics, this is actually a demonstration from the Scandinavian lot who produced Deep and Surface Learning. They got students just at the end of their introductory economics course, and they asked them a plain language question, which I think was, why does a loaf of bread cost a pound, or whatever it did in that country at that time. And they got these open-ended responses, and what they showed was that almost all the students talked about the cost of the flour and the cost of the baker's labour, and none of them mentioned anything about demand. And yet in a famine, first thing that happens if the government doesn't clamp down is that the price skyrockets because there are more people wanting bread than don't. So those economic students had undoubtedly had several lectures on the law of supply and demand and completely not connected them to the most everyday economics that they personally experience every day. So that would be an economics example of the desirability, but also typically the absence of students linking personal experience to what they're being taught. In zoology, it'd be the difference of watching a bird live versus studying taxonomy. In psychology, maybe it's the difference between reading about working memory and actually connecting that to your experience of holding phone numbers in the mind, but that's an out-of-date example. Do you guys ever hold anything in the mind? What do you struggle to remember temporarily? Of course, enough stuff in the exam, right, yes. That's right. Working memory, chunking theory, and how you feel and struggle in exams. So I believe this is a general educational principle. Right, now, this principle you can think about as feedback and convergence. Iteration is, how many of you know what iteration means? Nobody? Yes. It's taken several years for students to let me know. This is a piece of computing science jargon where it's absolutely, well, also mathematics, but above all computing science. It just means doing something repetitively in a circle, usually until some criterion is satisfied. It's another metaphor which works for me, but not for the learners I should be adapting to. But it's the same business, about going to and fro, but also eventually terminating successfully at where you are aiming for. So, this principle. Some of the associated features of this principle are, well, first of all, it stresses that learners have to act, that learning won't be going well if they are just passive, they have to apply. That probably means processing and re-expressing the knowledge. Feedback from the effects of the action can be very helpful. I'm not sure how much I'll squeeze into this course on feedback. Lorillard says feedback's essential for all learning, but many of you will have experiences that appear to contradict that of learning by reading and a bit of thinking. I think in this context, what's important to remember is how much we learn from doing something even unsuccessfully, because, well, particularly with an essay, because you have a little critic in the head, and it might not be as good a critic as you want, but it's actually already very sophisticated. And you can tell as you write that this isn't good. You don't need someone else that, you know, and you can say quite a bit about the way in which it's not satisfying you. And it's just the same still for me. When I write something out, that's when things I was completely confident I knew, I discover I don't, or I'd be able to write a lucid description with examples just like that. And when I can't do that, I'm getting feedback not just about my writing, but my extent of my understanding. So I think what's neglected by overemphasis on feedback, at least feedback from a human, is that we learn a tremendous amount simply from attempting a task. Obviously with a physical task, like trying to put a basketball through a hoop, you don't need a human to tell you whether it's in. But more surprisingly, even with re-expressing in language your current understanding, it's amazing how much you learn from the attempt, not from the feedback. And then when you read, you may, actually I don't have a reference for this on the list, but there has been work which I don't think has been disproved but sounded so astonishing that some athletes, and maybe this is a Russian research, some athletes gain from rehearsing in their head without moving a limb some sports thing, and that sounds quite hard to understand. We think of muscle growth, it's not going to do that, is it? But actually a lot of learning is about this is such a sidetrack, I'll say it briefly. There's a view, which is probably right, that we're constantly tuning our actions. So once you start looking for it in yourself, you'll probably catch yourself doing stuff. I don't know what will be a good example for you, but I've recently had a new central heating boiler. I have to learn how to use these controls, and day by day I'm still learning what my routine is. Should I turn the tap on? Should I fiddle with the controls? And each time I'm probably refining what I do. But even with repetitive activities like, I don't know, packing a bag or something, you progressively redo and just slightly optimize your actions. And actually that's about planning the sequence of actions. So that part of learning actually maybe could go on without you lifting a finger. And that could be, I don't know if you still do it, as a boy I'd rehearse what I was going to say to shopkeepers, who seemed a bit frightening to me, but still with some people I think about conversations in advance and rehearse them. I probably don't do it all that similarly to the rehearsal, but something in me certainly seems to feel that rehearsing is generally helpful. I mean, not for easy conversations, but for ones where I'm not sure. So, depending on how you define feedback, you might have different views on its relative contribution, but you shouldn't doubt the fact that being active about doing something and doing something central to the learning is a real aid in every way. You can reconceive that as feedback from your inner critic, and there's probably a lot of truth in that, but who knows. After all, I think part of the reason that's true is because just because we can estimate how good something is, how good a sentence of yours, of one's own, is when you look at it, doesn't mean you've got a way of improving it directly. So when I was writing my PhD, I was living with another person writing a PhD, and he wrote slowly, he'd be lucky to manage a few hundred words a day, and when he was trying to cheer himself up, he'd say things like, "Well, Steve, I know all the words I'm going to use, I just have to guess the order now." And that actually, of course, says something about how you can have the elements, but there's still a huge amount of work in looking at different orders, and you don't necessarily have much of an algorithm for generating the right order, you just try one and critique it. It's clear this is consistent with Dave Wood's stuff on contingent tutoring. Her model, because it's scrupulously even-handed between teacher and learner, talks, unlike many things written about higher education, on the feedback from learners to teachers in various ways about what, well, it might be feedback's just used for a teacher's understanding of that individual student at this moment, or it might be more generally about how the word iteration works on everyone in computer science and zero people in psychology. And actually the teachers getting different kinds of feedback, in fact. So they typically, certainly the first time or two they teach a course, they learn more about the subject. They certainly learn stuff on the general quality of how much learners grasp. They learn what does and doesn't seem effective in their current version of teaching. Three is really another language about aspects of contingent tutoring, about each side adapting to what the other just said. And that's why I use the word convergence, because it may be that teachers adapting how they express something almost as much as the learner is adapting their partial understanding. One thing to bear in mind is that feedback for a university student may come from a number of different kinds of interaction, and Lorillard doesn't, she says she does, but she doesn't really deal with this very fully. So there may be feedback from an expert teacher, there may be feedback from peers, or at least there may be interaction which positively affects the learning process. Certainly if you get any concrete labs or try anything out, you get feedback from the world. And you can get feedback from yourself if you put time into reflection, into going over your understandings and improving them or detecting what needs more work. And large parts of the literature tend to, they emphasize one or the other. But I think Lorillard's B principle is in fact pointing at all of them. And that's one of the reasons why I like her model, is it captures what other people tend to get individual fragments of. I think I won't pause on this because I want to get onto this. So, in the Chi paper I had you tackle, she discusses her results in terms of her active constructive interactive framework. She also had another paper the year after just about this framework, and I think it it's associated quite strongly with this principle implicit in Lorillard. So, the 2009 is the paper that's solely about this framework. So she proposed a scale of increasing learning effectiveness where useful but the least effective is active, for instance answering a closed question. The next one she calls constructive and is about generating open-ended responses, privately or not, what she calls self-explanations. And the most effective, the peer one, is interaction with another person, particularly a peer. A feature of all of those is that they involve mental processing and reprocessing of the matter being learned, and so does Lorillard's model. From a general point of view, I find those are the three things she focuses on, because her data and years of research all are well related to that. But it implies to me a fuller spectrum with her explicit categories there, but if active is her lowest category, there must be an inattentive category. People can be in a classroom and paying no attention at all, or they can be passive, or, and parts of the literature, it's important to bear this in mind, is that there's some literature which says it's good for children to be interactive. It's true it makes them awake and pleased. It's not true that all such interaction has any effect on learning at all. So, people in primary school filling in colouring books and not actually learning anything conceptual while they're doing it, even though they're being interactive. Similarly, if you have if you simply wrap a computer game process around some academic content, but the process of the game doesn't really interact with the real content, then there'll be lots of finger pushing, there won't be any mental reprocessing. It occurred to me in the last day or two that this could be linked to revision techniques. So I'm not an expert on this literature, although I have a few references on it. On the reading list, if you search for the tag memory and study strategies, you'll pick up a few of them. But various bits of literature seem to fit very well with Chi's thing. So although it's often done, mere rereading, which would be B on that list, sorry, I haven't got it on the handout, doesn't have any easily measurable effect. A lot of students feel that using a highlight pen to deface their printouts is useful, but actually that's interaction and sense of physical movement, but it's not actually associated with processing the content. On the other hand, D, rewriting notes by transforming their representation, really does have an effect. So some years ago I had a Maxi student who did her Maxi project on the original theme was mind mapping and whether teaching students in her class to use mind mapping would improve their learning. But the results didn't come out exactly as she expected. It turned out that what made the biggest positive difference was if they used a representation that was different from the one in which they'd used for the original notes. So if they already use mind mapping, they get a large benefit from turning it into bullet points. If they'd use bullet points, turning it into mind maps would get that large thing. So it was the transformation, particularly one that required some sort of translation. Because just as we naively think that translating something from French to English is a simple process, anyone who tries it realizes you have to think all the time about the meaning and try and minimize the loss of meaning. And it's that thinking about the meaning hard that really makes a difference to learning. Constructive E, so generating explanations, and as long as it's generating one rather than reproducing one. And then probably, although all the devil is in the detail, there are kinds of peer interaction which can add even more value, but it is a particular kind of interaction which I hope to be talking about next time. Rüdiger and Karpiker had a little burst of papers on revision strategies for students, which are interesting in various ways, and if you're interested in this you can have a look at them, and I've got some of their references on the reading list if you want to sample them. They don't have the wider perspective suggested on this slide and by Chi, but they do have real experimental results to contrast some of the conditions which you'd be interested in. Don't mind me overrunning by 5 minutes, I'll just finish off Lorillard. So, in some areas of the education literature, reflection is a big deal. If you go into, say, nursing, but also some other professions, you're quite likely to be required to do reflection, say, on critical incidents, as part of your professional training and indeed your permanent professional practice. So, in some places, reflection has a big profile, has various different meanings of it. I'm just giving you a little briefing here. So, Oxford English Dictionary there says reflect is go back in thought or meditate. Schoen is one big person who published in this area, but Kolb is another. So that's the Kolb cycle. You can see this fits quite well with Lorillard's personal on the bottom to abstract at the top, connected by reflective things. It doesn't represent the teacher and learner, but it represents the other bit. So depending on which author on reflection you get, you'll probably get a different subset of all the relevant meanings you might get. I mention that because, as I say, there's been a time, and maybe still, some of these names are important, and they link to Lorillard here. Reflection, as I've already mentioned, is clear to me anyway. It's clear it relates to deep learning, about ploughing through what you know, trying to look for connections. So that's a Kolb cycle. Now, mathemogenic is just a technical term that means producing learning. Lorillard uses it a little, but it hasn't really taken off. But why I use it here is because the trickiest thing about getting serious about the Lorillard model is to decide how best to define her activity. If you think about it as an ideal, especially as I think the evidence generally points to, what matters is the processing in the learner's mind. And you can't measure that directly. We don't have a convenient probe that tells us they're now spending 5 minutes chewing on something intellectual to do with a topic. So her model's probably truest in that ideal interpretation, but it's then hard to connect it reliably to empirical things. There's also the question about whether a given activity always causes learning or just is good on average. So that's some of the tricky bit. So what I would, if you do the exercise I'd like you to have a quick fiddle at for homework, you'll pick some course, try and inspect that course for whether you can identify how many of her activities you can identify in the course. But the difficult thing is that some of those activities will be internalized. So probably a lot of level 4 students will do reflection without the teacher doing anything external to embody that. But that would not be true for much younger people. So the question, similarly, you hand in a bit of work and you might or might not pay attention to what the tutor says, but the critic in your head is probably telling you plenty about how you'll do this better next time. So if that to and fro-ness between, as it were, a teacher and a learner is actually not done by a physical teacher but by a part of you because you're able to internalise that activity, it becomes less important to have the external teacher do something. So part of the difficulty in using this on courses is how much of those activities you can rely on this particular kind of learner to do without being explicitly scaffolded, and how much it's definitely not usual practice for them, and therefore the course ideally would put in something for it. So that's what you need to have a go at that. Any questions before we all evaporate? I think that would be my summary of why this is important. It has not one but three general principles. These slides are already up on the page. Okay, thank you.